Today we're going to take up the matter of Nehemiah and his work in the reconstruction of Jewish life in Judea. I asked you to preview the book of Nehemiah and to begin by isolating the problems that he had to face, because we cannot take the measure of the man and his accomplishments if we don't have some idea of what he had to overcome. This is a significant factor. Okay, what was one problem that you found in the text that he had to overcome or resolve? Let's start with Dave Vandegrift. This guy. I don't know about that pronunciation. Okay. Okay, who exactly was, what was Sanballat? Was he just some guy running around in a bed sheet? Or did Nehemiah have some specific reason to worry about this man's opposition, It's like people sometimes have come on campus literally wrapped in bed sheets and said that they're the Archangel Michael or whoever, and we haven't had to take much notice of that kind of opposition. What kind of threat did this pose? It depends on who this man was. What position did he occupy here? If you've been reading your textbook, you should know. Don? Yeah, he was the governor of Samaria. He was the officially appointed Persian governor of Samaria. Now, along with Sanballat, did you pick up the names of any other confederates that were working sort of hand in glove with him? Neil? Okay, Tobiah is called what? Well, he's called the servant, which is maybe a bad term because it doesn't mean he was some sort of a slave. Everybody, to call oneself the servant is actually an honorific title. It may not sound like one, but it meant the servant of the Persian emperor. And of course, that meant a political appointee of the Persian emperor. And Tobiah was the governor of Ammon. See, remember, we have Judea here. Samaria is located to the north. And so we have Sanballat, who is the governor there. Ammon is across the Jordan River, another Persian province. And Tobiah is the governor there. Who else in this unholy trinity need we mention? Mike? Geshem, okay. Or Gashmu, as he sometimes is called in the literature. He's called Geshem the Arabian because he was a Nabataean. More specifically, all of us, I think, have heard of the city of Petra. And Petra was the main Nabataean city along the trade route from the Red Sea and from deep in Arabia. The people of Petra had already moved over into what is really southern Judea. You've got this region down here, which is now being called Idumea, because it's also largely Edomite in population. As you see, over here you've got Petra, which was in the ancient land of Edom. What happened when the Jews, of course, were exiled to Babylon, is this whole area over here became empty, pretty much. Now, the Edomites were no dopes. Judea is not the most thrilling landscape either, but it's a lot better than Edom. And so the Edomites had moved over to occupy at least the southern parts of Judea. And the Nabataeans, who had been an Arabian people, had moved into Edom. And there had been sort of a population replacement. And so the Nabataeans, who came out of Arabia, were living over there at Petra, and the Edomites had come over here. Now, this man Geshem is called an Arabian because he's one of these Nabataeans, and he was the governor of this region, and regions further out into the desert, because the Nabataeans had quite an extensive sway over those desert areas and the caravan routes that made them so important. So this man, Geshem, is governor over a very extensive region, starting to the south of Judea, and of course, working its way southeast. Now, we don't have any opponent from the west. Why? They say that the further from the source of light you get more darkness. Considering he comes from what is called the Antipodes from Australia, that explains everything. Okay. So this was a very significant problem. Nehemiah, as we will find out, had, of course, an official standing. He's the governor of Judea. But in dealing with the problems of Judea, he has to face the active opposition of all of the other surrounding governors. And Geshem, perhaps, is the most important. Even though more space is given to Sanballat in the account, Geshem is the more significant enemy, because we know from secular recorded history he was intimately acquainted with the Persian emperor. He wasn't just one of the governors. He had, through marriage relations, a very close personal connection to the emperor himself. He was sort of a distant relative by marriage, and therefore intimately acquainted with the emperor. And therefore, his opposition was something very important. We'll see how that comes into the account in the book of Nehemiah itself a little later. So this is one problem. What else does Nehemiah have to face as he tries to resolve all these problems in Judea? Tom? Okay, there was a great deal of economic suffering. The economy was in shambles, largely. So this is another problem that he had to deal with. Another one? Dan? Okay, the city of Jerusalem had no wall. And of course, this is the problem that in the opening of the book of Nehemiah is what is brought to his attention, and is what the occasion for his going to Judea in the first place, is the people of Jerusalem have no wall. Now, why is that important? Why not just say, well, big deal, they had no wall. Why is that a problem? Mr. Knocker? Exactly. These enemies were constantly raiding the city, keeping the people in practical terror, and of course preventing them from doing anything of any consequence. And as a result of the fact that they had no wall, and therefore they were subject to these raids, you had another problem the Jerusalem experienced that Nehemiah had to resolve, a related one, which is that it had almost no population. It had no significant population. This is something that is addressed in chapter 13, as we'll see later when we get into the book itself, that Nehemiah literally had to dragoon people into living in Jerusalem because he wanted to live there. It was safer living in the rest of Judea. You might say, well, they didn't have any wall in Judea either. Yeah, but the main focus of the attacks was always Jerusalem. So as long as Jerusalem had no wall, who wanted to live there? Now, it was bad enough to have all this opposition from the external bigwigs, but he also had a companion problem of traitors within the gates. Who did he have to number among these traitors within the gates who were in sympathy with the enemy? Against their own people. Well, not one of them. There was, in these days, there was only one at a time. In the time of Jesus, this is different. So you have to know which year you're talking about. Yeah. I know what you mean. It's a conventional way of saying it. The man who was the high priest himself, and therefore the highest ranking individual in Judea, you know, in terms of any other's social status, was working hand in glove with especially Tobiah, as we'll come to see, as we'll see that in its proper place. Who else was working with the enemies? Yeah, well, the nobles were, of course, subverting God's law that way, too. But more than that, they were engaging in correspondence with Tobiah, leaking things. Once Nehemiah gets to Jerusalem and starts working, they're sort of betraying the things that he's doing and giving secret information to Tobiah. So the nobles of Judea, as well as the high priest. And then, of course, the son of the high priest was married to the daughter of Sanballat. And so he was working hand in glove with Sanballat. So you've got very high-ranking opposition. What other problems did he have to face? Yes, David? Well, these are organizational problems. But you see, that has to do with the wall itself. I'm talking about a completely separate problem. Larry? Right, profaning of the Sabbath, definitely. Big problem. We could also mention the absence of social justice. The poor were being sold into slavery. And we could finally round it out, because this, I think, gives us how many problems? Eight. You count differently than I do. Okay. It doesn't matter. You know I don't go by points anyway on these tests. List the seven problems Nehemiah faced now. We were talking about Eliashib working with Tobiah and the nobles working with Tobiah. That's obviously part of the same problem, that he has collaborationists within the gates. We have just the fact that the temple is not functioning. And why isn't the temple functioning? Because who does all the work? The Levites. And why aren't they doing the work? They're not there. And why aren't they there? Pardon? No. There are still some Levites here. They left. Why? Ah, but why? Somebody yelled it out over there. They weren't getting paid. In other words, God's law provides that the Levites get certain portions based on the work they do in the temple. And they weren't being paid what they were supposed to be paid. So they had no way to earn a living. So naturally they did the only sensible thing. They left and went to their own property. And they were earning their living on their own property. That's all. So the temple stopped functioning, in essence, too. So you've got a whole complex of problems. Now, who is this guy, Nehemiah, who has to be thrust into the midst of all these tightly interwoven, interconnected problems, this can of worms? I must use another expression, but I don't think I will. Who is this guy? What do we know about him? Gary? Right.
And that was supposed to be a very trusted position.
Exactly, because we read in the text, in chapter 1, in verse 11, the last phrase of the verse, "For I was the king's cupbearer." Now, as Gary explained, this is not does not mean that that describes Nehemiah as being some menial servant at the Persian court. Sort of like one step up from the groom of the back stairs. You know, this is not that kind of a deal. The king's cupbearer, because he was privileged to actually hand the wine to the king himself, was obviously somebody the king trusted a great deal, because otherwise that wine could easily be poisoned. And so the person who got the job of being the cupbearer was somebody who had already earned the respect and trust, absolute trust, obviously, of the emperor, because he had already served him as some other major official in the government. And the king had come to trust him absolutely. And so he rewarded him by this position of being the cupbearer, because his very life depended on who his cupbearer was. So that tells us that Nehemiah is not somebody who is inexperienced when it comes to government administration. That this is somebody who has a great deal of savvy, a great deal of ability. Now, we're not going to take up the question of the chronology of Nehemiah's return to Judea and his work in Judea, as opposed to Ezra's return and his work. We will address that next time. But now let's just focus on what it is that Nehemiah does in solving these particular problems that we have enumerated. In doing so, I'm not going to take it problem by problem, but look at it from the point of view of the skills or qualities or characteristics that Nehemiah had that made him able to effectively solve this very complicated, interconnected set of problems. The first of his qualities or abilities or skills that made him capable of resolving all the problems we've listed is that he was a man of tremendous organizational ability. He was an effective organizer, a very knowledgeable organizer. Notice in chapter 2, after he arrives there, or even before he gets there, when he's asking the king for permission to go on this assignment and that permission is granted, notice in chapter 2, verse 7, that he is wise enough to ask for something before he even leaves Persia. He says, if it please the king, which is just a standard opening address, because nothing gets done if it doesn't please the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of Arnachar, that they may convey me over until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make the beams for the gates of the palace, which pertains to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. So the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So you notice he comes armed with official letters directing all other major officials of the king to render due aid and assistance. This way, there's not a doubt in any of these men's minds that this man is entitled to make demands upon them. Notice that when he gets to Jerusalem, that before he does anything, what does he do? Notice in verse 11. I came to Jerusalem. Does he immediately call the people together and say, look, people, we've got a problem. We've got this wall. It needs to be finished. We're going to go and build it. No, first of all, it says he stayed there 3 days. Now, that's a sign, you know, of a man who knows what he's doing. He doesn't just jump at the task. He's there, and he gets a feel for the situation. You see, he's getting a feel for the dimensions of the task. Notice what he does. He arose in the night with a few men with him, and I told no one what God had put in my heart to do. In other words, he hadn't spoken to anybody about why he had even come to Jerusalem. Nobody had a clue as to why he had come as the new governor of Judea. And he went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the Dragon Well, which is the spring which still exists on the eastern side of the city of David, known as the Gihon Spring. The reason why it's called the Dragon Well here is because they had a folk tale in those days that explain the behavior of the spring. Because the spring is called Gihon today, the Gihon spring, which in Hebrew means the gusher. Because it just doesn't flow on a regular basis. It flows all the time. But in winter, five times a day, it literally suddenly gushes forth an enormous amount of water. In the summer, twice a day, it will suddenly start to put out more. And of course, people begin to wonder, well, why does it suddenly give out more than at other times? And they have this folk tale about a dragon living deep in the hill, and he was the one responsible for the spring gushing from time to time. So this is this, we can identify this place quite readily. So he went out that way to the Dung Gate and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates that were consumed with fire. And it shows how he made a complete circuit of the city. In other words, he studied personally with his own eyes, and he says he took only a few men with him, probably experts, who could advise him on exactly what would be involved. So he's getting hard, factual, observational data about the dimensions of the task that he's about to organize the people to do. As it says in verse 16, the rulers didn't even know I had gone or what I did, because I hadn't yet told it to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the rulers or to any of the others that were trying to build the wall. So you see, this was very, very clever. He studied the thing firsthand. Now, we have another example of his organizational ability. In chapter 3, you have a long description of who was set to working on different parts of the wall. Now, what seems to emerge are two things. If you were to read it in detail, you would get two major pieces of information from the way he organized the actual working on building the wall. And that is, one, he involved every segment of the community. He made it a community-wide effort rather than just the work of a few hired professional workers. Now, what's the advantage organizationally of doing that? Should be obvious. Yeah, and you get this, what's this word? Some what? Yeah, but because of the unity you get something. Well, synergy. Synergy is a very interesting thing. It proves that human beings are not objects. What do I mean by that? I mean the following. There is a mathematical principle that the whole is equal to what? Sum of the individual parts. But with human beings, it doesn't work that way. With human beings, the effort of one person plus the effort of another person plus the effort of another person does not equal the effort of three people. It equals more than the effort of three people, because there's a certain feeding off of one of each other when you're all unified doing the same task with a great, you know, desire to see it accomplished. It's one of those mysteries that people, when they do things in such a unified way, a lot more gets done that could be get done by each of them working apart, doing, you know, working on each segment of it without this synergistic energy that liberates greater effort. This is one of the things that I guess doesn't happen very often here in the work anymore. I still remember that I came, not in the dark ages of the work, but I don't go back that far. At least when I still came to college, a regular feature of college life was envelope stuffing parties, where in the semi-annual letter or the next co-worker letter was going out, we'd all go down and we'd stuff envelopes, and literally that's what we would do. And, you know, it may not have been a huge thing, but it was an amazing degree of energy that was liberated, you know, and enthusiasm for the work overall because of just being involved together in a simple little task like envelope stuffing. Maybe you remember those days when you were around here. There's something very special about that. Anyway, he understood that principle, and so he organized the work that way, that it involved the whole community. It was a community-wide effort. He also did something else that was very good organizationally. We have discovered through archaeology the wall that King Asa very quickly built around the city of Mitzpah, north of Jerusalem, because of the threat of an attack from the northern kingdom of Israel. We found out that it was a very interesting wall, because parts of it were built very well and very strong, and other parts were built very poorly. And it was very uneven in its quality of construction all the way around. It seems that where the residents of Jerusalem were concerned in building this wall, where did he assign them to work? True. If an enemy is going to attack this city, this is one place they're not going to break through the wall. Very shrewd man. Then, of course, he... I should say there's a third aspect, which is, of course, that he recognized that since they would be attacked while, or theoretically they could be attacked while they were building, as they had been in the past, this is one reason they had been building for years and had never gotten anything built up. Sort of like in mythology of the, I think, of Pandora's web. Not Pandora's web. Penelope's web. Penelope's web. The wife of Odysseus, when he was gone in the Trojan Wars, was beset by a literal army of suitors demanding she choose one of them as her new husband. And she said, well, not until I weave the shroud for my husband. And so she sat all day in the great hall of the palace in front of them all, weaving the shroud every day. But then at night, in her bedchamber, she undid what she had woven the day during the day. And so she postponed her decision, which she managed to do for 10 years until he got home. The suitors didn't care. They were eating up everything that he owned anyway, so having a good old time. So, but the point is, it became a symbol of a project that is forever doing and never gets finished. Well, this wall was like that. They kept trying to build it, and they get a little bit built, and the enemies would come and knock it down, and they'd just start again and never get anywhere with it. So what did he do? What did he realize had to be done besides getting everybody involved? What technique did he use to make sure that the enemies would be at least tempted to stay away and not bother the work? Wes? Yeah, they worked in shifts that way. Is that everybody had their own weapon, but half of the people would be working on one shift while the other half guarded, let's say like for 2 hours or 3 hours, then they'd switch off, see? And they would, so this is good organizational thinking, given the problems he was facing. So you can see that he was an organized person from that standpoint. Yes?
I'm curious to know why he couldn't petition the king of Persia to get the other guys off the back.
Yeah, I have to remember, though, it doesn't make him look very effective an administrator if he has to keep running back to his boss for authority all the time. You see, it doesn't work very well that well. And the Persian governor, you know, and the Persian emperor would not have been too pleased, you know, being bothered with these problems at this particular time either. We'll understand that more fully when we look at the setting in which this whole thing takes place. No, it was a matter that he is the one responsible. He's expected to solve all problems on the spot. That's just the way the system works. And you see, he used a number of different techniques in doing that. Notice something else about his organizational ability. Chapter 7. Maybe you've read this, but just didn't give it a whole lot of thought. It came to pass when the wall was built and I had set up the doors, and the porters and the singers and the Levites were appointed, which is another problem. He took care of taking care of the temple staff, getting them reappointed to their jobs and their portions assigned to them, that I gave my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the ruler of the palace, charge over Jerusalem. Now, why did he give these people major government responsibilities? It's not just because Hanani was his brother. It explains it right there in the verse. Because he was a faithful man and feared God above many. In other words, he recognized the important qualifications for people to have office under him. And that is, they have this essential quality. So he knew that the job would be, you know, well taken care of. That's part of being a man of organizational ability, is knowing how to pick the proper subordinates. And he knew that this was the most single important quality these people would have had to have. Now, it says here that after the porters, the singers, and the Levites were appointed, chapter 13, you have mention of this in verses 30 and 31. He's talking about the priesthood and the Levites, that he cleansed them of all strangers and appointed the wards of the priests. What does it mean, the wards of the priests? Well, you're all priests, but what does it mean when you have different wards? What's a word in the New Testament that's used instead of ward? That's equivalent. Well, courses. The courses of the priests. In other words, he reinstituted the system that David had instituted, that having the priests serve by course in an orderly fashion. You see. And everyone in his business, and of course, according to the way God had assigned the responsibilities, God had dictated which groups of Levites did what. But David had organized the various priests according to courses, and he's the one that Nehemiah restores that, you see. It also says, I can't find the specific reference here. See if I can find it. Maybe it wasn't 7. To make sure that the Levites got all their portions. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Chapter 12. That they were... there's some appointed to be over, sort of treasurers over the various tithes and other offerings, so that the, you know, everybody would get, you know, their particular portions. It's in chapter 12, verse 44. So, you know, he knew that had to be done, that you had to appoint subordinates to take care of these things. One of the most difficult things about leadership is to recognize the need to delegate responsibility. There's a trap that many potential leaders fall into, is they want to do everything themselves. They figure, I've got the responsibility, I better do it. You can't do it all unless your area of responsibility is very tiny. You have to delegate. And of course, in any church area, if you've ever observed the way your own church area at home is organized, that's definitely employed. The minister couldn't possibly oversee everything that's done to keep the church area running properly. He has to delegate, whether to his local elders, certain things, to deacons, and different deacons, different areas of responsibility, deaconesses sometimes as well. This is a principle that must be employed, is delegation. And we see that he was organized and efficient that way, that he delegated, he created these treasurers. And in the case of his brother and this other man, Hananiah, that once he got the thing ready to run, he turned over major responsibility to these men, because he knew he just couldn't run everything by himself. Very important part of being a man who is a good organizer is to recognize this and then to delegate effectively. Okay, point number 2 about his qualities. There were an enormous number of difficult problems that had to be resolved, especially this matter of the wall. And in everything he did, it is clear Nehemiah set the example by applying all of his energy to the task at hand. He was out there in front, visibly leading. Now, it doesn't mean every leader must always be way out in front, visibly leading. But especially in the most difficult moments, this greatly inspires those under you. The example is given in chapter 4 of the fact when they were doing the work on the wall. Chapter 4, verse 23. He makes this sort of parenthetical comment. Neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, except, of course, for occasional washing. In other words, they were at the task day and night, you see, right out there where the people could see their example of total involvement. And so because he showed by his total involvement how much he cared about the task, he could expect others to do likewise. So this is a very important quality of his leadership, is that he so visibly applied all of his own personal energy to the task. Point number 3, he was personally courageous. He was personally courageous. He had a lot of this opposition from the neighboring governors. In chapter 6, we read of several attempts by the neighboring governors to get him away from the task of building the wall, which he turns aside. Finally, this last literal threat comes to him. Notice this in chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 5. Then sent Sanballat his servant to me in like manner the fifth time. In other words, this is the fifth attempt of Sanballat to get him to leave off directing the work on the wall, with an open letter in his hand. Now, what does it mean, an open letter? Well, letters those days were rolled up and then sealed with not only cord, but a seal to show that it hadn't been read by the bearer. And so this was open, so the bearer obviously knew the contents and was free to kind of go to the local saloon afterwards, and after he performed his mission, and sort of spread the word about what message he had brought, in which it was written, "It is reported," I love that phrase, "it is reported among the heathen, and Geshem also says it." This is Geshem the Arabian, the governor of this large southern area, "that you and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause you're building the wall, that you may be their king. You have also appointed prophets to preach of yourself in Jerusalem, saying that there is a king in Judah, and now it shall be reported to the Persian king according to these words, unless, of course, you come down and meet with us." Now, that was quite an important threat, because the worst possible threat, you might say, accusation that could be leveled at the Persian court would be that Nehemiah, the trusted servant of the king, is using the occasion of his being governor over here in Judea to foment a rebellion and make himself king over Judea. And as I say, it says Geshem also says it. Because, as I said, Geshem was personally related by marriage to the Persian emperor. So this was meant to underline the threat. Well, Nehemiah showed courage. He was not dissuaded by this threat. Notice also something else that happened in verse 10. This man, pretending to do him a favor, comes to him and says, "Let us meet in the house of God within the temple, let's shut the doors of the temple, because they will be coming to kill you. In the night, they're coming to assassinate you. And what does Nehemiah say? Should such a man as I flee? Should it be noised abroad that I've gone into the temple to save my life? You know, what kind of example is the leader in front of all the people who are under similar threats themselves do I become? If their leader is so scared, how are they supposed to have courage? And so even though he knew he could possibly be assassinated, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. So it's another example of his personal courage. Notice in chapter 13 how he treats the high priest. Now this is the high priest he's talking to. Chapter 13, verse 4. Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied to Tobiah, and had prepared for him a great chamber, where before time they had put the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, the tithes of the corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, the singers, and the porters. So when he comes back to Jerusalem and finds out that Eliashib has taken this sacred chamber and has turned it into a secular use as a lodging place for the governor of Ammon, what does he do? Verse 8, it grieved me sore. I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. And I commanded and cleansed the chambers, that they should bring in again the vessels and the meat offerings and the frankincense. In other words, he didn't go to the priest and say, I don't think you're doing the right thing here. Please, pretty please, would you take care of it? He just took action. In other words, he showed up, the high priest made him a public laughingstock, made him a public example. He wasn't afraid to take strong action when it was necessary, and thus upbraid the high priest for his actions. The same thing with the nobles of Judah in the matter of taking of the poor people as slaves. Notice how he talks to them in chapter 5. Verse 6. Notice how it's described here. When he hears about all this slavery, he was very angry when I heard the cry of the poor and these words. I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said to them, you exact usury, every one of his brother. And he set a great assembly against them. He publicly rebuked the nobles for their behavior. He didn't just privately go to them and say, now, boys, I think you've been bad boys. I think you better reform your behavior. He publicly rebuked them in no uncertain terms to get them to change their mode of behavior. This brings up a fourth quality, which is that Nehemiah was a man of discernment. He knew how to work with people. If we use the example of the wall again, we took note of the fact that before they even tried to get the people to work on the wall, he learned the dimensions of the problem. Then notice how he begins to tackle the whole project. It has to do with popular psychology, or I should say, mass psychology. Chapter 2, let's take a look at this in verse 12. Not verse 12, sorry. Verse 17. He calls all the rulers together. And he says, you see the distress that we're in, how Jerusalem lies waste, the gates are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we be no more a reproach. So first he is challenging them to do the task. But notice, in order to strengthen them in their resolve, what he tells them. I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that have been spoken to me. In other words, he told them, look, I have such favor with the Persian king. He's trying to get them to have spirit for the task by showing how much the king is behind the project. And so they said, let us rise up and build. So they were then motivated for doing it. We can even look at the way he organized the work as being a case of understanding psychology, being a man of discernment. The fact that he saw the necessity of having people who lived in Jerusalem build the part of the wall that was closest to them, to their homes. Or the way he dealt with these nobles. He didn't just rebuke them and then demand a public statement that they will give up their slaves that they have taken illegally, contrary to God's law. But as soon as he got them to publicly say they would do it, he calls in the priests and makes them take a public oath in the name of God that they would do it. So he's not just, well, we're all good boys together, we'll just take your word and let you off the hook. You see, he understood that once he had that commitment, he was going to tie it down with a public oath-taking ceremony. That he understood what was necessary to be done from the point of view of how people are affected by the way things are done. This is something that was a very important part of his characteristic. Number five, because we've had one, organizational ability. Two, he applied all his energy to the task. Three, he was courageous. Four, he was a man of discernment. Five, in chapter 5, notice something he willingly, voluntarily did. Remember, the people were very, very poor. Chapter 5, verse 10. I likewise and my brethren and my servants have the right by law and custom to exact of the people money and grain. Because he was the governor. He had the right to tax the people for his own maintenance. But what did he do? Verse 15. The former governors that had been before me were chargeable to the people and have taken of them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. But I have not. He willingly did not take that which was his due because the people were so poor, that he might set the right example, that he was there as their governor, not to feed at their expense, but he was there as their governor to serve them. Sort of like Paul talking to the Corinthians. So you're so worried that I'm in this for your wealth. When have I ever charged you anything? In fact, I've deliberately avoided doing it, even when I was entitled to it. Same principle. Or setting an absolute clear example of personal integrity. So that he could not possibly be accused of just being their leader because of the good living that would come from it. Point number 6 is that throughout, even though he was a man who enjoyed the trust of the emperor and enormous personal abilities, he depended primarily on God for his success. Even at the very beginning, when he got the desire to want to go back to Judea, did he just go to the emperor and say, look, you know me, I'm one of your high officials, you trust me, I'm your wine servant, give me leave that I can go and do this assignment. Give me the appointment. The first thing he did was to pray, asking God for favor so that he'd be able to carry out this task on behalf of the people. And throughout, he puts his trust in God primarily, not in his own abilities, which were significant. It's a constant reference to how much he depends on God. And finally, number 7, you can have all of these things, but Nehemiah sets us an example in one last respect. And that is the whole purpose for his leaving his comfortable position at Persia, where he didn't have to fight for his authority. He had an acknowledged position, a regular routine, comfortably enjoying life. He left all that, underwent this long and difficult journey to Judea, faced all these problems for what reason? To magnify his position in Persia? No, it would have no effect on that. Simply because he wanted to give something to the people of Judah and Jerusalem. He wanted to give them their security, which was a key to their prosperity and a key to their hope. And he wanted to straighten out a lot of the religious problems that were present as well. The lack of social justice and, of course, the problems of the temple. He wanted to give, not get. And so that's why he gave up his comfortable position and came not once, but twice to Judea to serve as governor. Just get the country organized and back on track. Okay, we'll pick up next time with the matter of the chronology of Ezra and Nehemiah. I suggest that your Bible study for the Sabbath could be very profitably, partially devoted to that. Read the section in the textbook dealing with the problems of the chronologies of Ezra and Nehemiah, and then study the scriptures that are mentioned specifically in the textbook and see what you make of the problem. Because you need to understand the dimensions of the problem.